From the heart of the Forest City, Blackburn Media presents the Craig Needles Podcast, looking at the biggest stories in London and around the world and how they impact you. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It is another new episode of the Craig Needles Podcast, and usually I've got a lot of energy and I'm hyped up and ready to go start these things because I'm excited to do them. But today, I'm just not necessarily feeling that way as I start the podcast. We'll start with news that has broken hearts and saddened people all over this community and elsewhere. It's sad. It's a tough week. It's been a hard week for first responders. It's been a hard week for people in the media like me. I was out there Tuesday night at this crash at the corner of Riverside and Wonderland. I was back out there Wednesday morning covering the latest, getting the details for the community. It's a hard week for first responders. Like I said, it's a hard week for people in media. It's a hard week for everybody. It's been a hard week for me as a dad of two young kids. I had to explain sort of the base circumstance of this to my 4-year-old daughter, because when I rushed out of my house the other night, on Tuesday night, she wondered where I was going, and I kind of had to tell her the next morning, hey, here's what happened. So it's been very, very hard. And part of the difficulty has been the not knowing as to what happened from Tuesday into Wednesday. And I'm not going to come on this podcast and speculate, because that's not what I'm going to do here. I will, however, tell you exactly what we know, things that we know occurred. We know that at 6:45 on Tuesday night, a car driven by a 76-year-old woman collided with at least one other car on Riverside Drive, just a few feet east of Wonderland. I was standing at the crash site. I saw the debris on Tuesday night. The woman, according to police, drives her car through a red light, hops a curb on the other side of the street, on the other side of Wonderland, hits a girl guide troop, hits a light standard, eventually goes to the other side of Riverside, hits a tree. The girl guide troop, along with an adult woman and a teen, a bunch of them rushed to hospital quickly. We know the driver, and this was key, I'll emphasize this in a second, was not taken to the hospital after the crash. We also know now, sadly, that Alexandra Stemp, an 8-year-old girl who was there with that girl guide troop, she died. And that has just been so, so difficult for me, so difficult for this community, because you know what? She was walking down a street in London, Ontario, something we've all done. And she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and now she's dead and her family's left to pick up the pieces. And I just cannot imagine how they are feeling. It just feels so senseless. A loss that there's no explanation for. No reason for. Now, I want to get back to the driver here, because there's been a lot of speculation that I've seen on social media. Again, we're not going to speculate here, but I'll tell you what I've been told on the record. I asked Constable Sandash Abow of London Police whether this was, you know, a medical issue, this is an impairment issue. The answer I got was the driver of this vehicle was not arrested at the scene and she was not taken to hospital. Do with that information what you will. But not arrested at the scene, not taken to hospital. Police say this investigation is going to take a few weeks. We'll give them that time. But in the meantime, I want there to be some focus on the family of this little girl who just doesn't have her anymore. A GoFundMe's been set up for them. You can go to londonnewstoday.ca right now. You can see a link to it if you want to donate. If you have the means, I really do hope you can. Because I cannot fathom what they might be going through. You know, I've been telling people this week, from my perspective, that the job that I do, which is, you know, covering media stories in this city, has become harder for me in the last 4 years. That's how old my daughter is. She's 4. And when stuff like this happens, I cannot help but think to myself, hey, what would it be like if this happened to my family, this happened to my kid? And I can't even imagine what that's like. And it wears on you. It does. And I'm sure it wears on police officers who were at the scene and firefighters who were at the scene and EMS staff who were at the scene. I'm sure it wears on them too. I'm sure they think about the same stuff that I do. I'm sure that you're probably thinking about it. You've got young kids or know people who do. So I hope you can support that GoFundMe if you can make that happen. I know that folks would appreciate it. I do think we should calm down a little bit when it comes to the speculation as far as how this crash occurred. I think we should give police the time, the few weeks they've asked for here to figure this out. I think there are conversations to be had when it comes to safety in this city. Not necessarily specific to this crash. Again, we'll let the investigation play out here. But what can we do to make it safer to be a pedestrian in this city? I think is a question that is appropriate to ask now, just as it was appropriate to ask on Monday morning before this happened. It's an appropriate question. And we're going to talk about that a little bit on the podcast next week. Again, we're not going to get into the specifics of how could this particular crash have been prevented, because I don't know. I don't want to sit here and guess as to what the cause was and then just decide, oh, this is the way it could have been prevented. We'll hear what the police say, then we can make a decision on that. That intersection, I will say, is one that when I was standing there, I sort of thought to myself, hey, maybe there are some safety issues here. You can't really see if you're going west on Riverside who might be coming eastbound because of the way the street bends. Wonderland essentially becomes a highway at that spot with speeds. Again, is speed a factor here? I don't know. The police haven't said that. But is Wonderland a spot where traffic goes very quickly? The answer is yes. And further to that, is speed an issue when it comes to a significant portion of collisions? The answer is yes. So these are all things that I think we can talk about without at the very same time saying, here's how this crash would have been prevented, because you don't know that, neither do I. We don't know. So we'll continue to mourn and be sad this week. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I know that my colleagues here at Blackburn Media are doing. It's going to be tough. It's not going to be easy. But we're going to do as best we can. And one of the ways I think we can do as best we can is to have honest and realistic conversations about this. I will say that when I was covering this, it did bring back memories of covering. Some people have said what happened at Hyde Park Road and Old Carriage Drive over the summer with that family of four Muslims, or five people who are Muslim, was run over by a white supremacist. This, to me, is very different from that. What it is not dissimilar to is what happened at Costco a few years back when a young girl was hit by a car driven by a woman named Ruth Berger, who fought as hard as she could at every turn in the legal system trying to punish her for that, which we can talk about the morality play there perhaps some other time. Nonetheless, that's what it brought back for me memories-wise, and the fact that we've had so many of things like this in the city that are comparable is not good. And it's not something, of course, that anyone ever wants to see happen. But the sad reality is it has. So we're just going to have to continue to navigate the situation. And I hope what comes from this is conversations as far as how can we make it so this is less likely to happen in the future. No matter what the police investigation outcome tells us, literally no matter what, there should be a conversation of how do we make this less likely to happen in the future. But we need to hear from the police investigation, in my opinion, before we start talking about that in reference to this specific crash. Can we talk about making things safer for pedestrians in this city? Yeah, we can talk about that. I think we should, in a general sense. And we're going to do that on the podcast next week. What we're going to do this week is shift gears a little bit and talk about housing. We're going to take a very quick break here and do that coming up. This is the Craig Needles Podcast, where we can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and of course at londonnewstoday.ca. As promised, we're back here on the Craig Needles Podcast, and we're talking housing. And we are going to be talking about housing with the CEO of the London Home Builders Association and former city councillor, Jared Zafeman, joining me here at the Blackburn Media Studios to have a conversation about all sorts of things, but specifically the fact that We're in a housing shortage right now. Jared, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here, Craig. A definitely important topic to be discussing.
It is an important topic. And I just, the idea, and we've seen it online, and I know you've seen Mike Moffitt's pieces on this, and he and I have talked about this. We have a housing shortage. That is a statement that you would accept, you think is factual, that we have a housing shortage, not just in London, but sort of Ontario-wide right now?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, depending on who you speak to, I would say that people would potentially call this a housing supply crisis across the province. And certainly here in London, it's no different.
And the results of that would mean prices for housing are higher, rents are higher, because, you know, economics 101, if the supply is low and the demand is high, that means that that particular item is going to become expensive.
Yes, correct. And certainly from that basic economic perspective, and that's, you know, I think what a lot of people are feeling and thinking right now is that if there was more supply in the market, then the demand would be better met, and then we wouldn't have nearly as high of these prices escalating.
So how do we increase the supply then? And we can talk about sort of individual specific instances when it comes to decisions that the City of London has made and planners have made, but how do we increase the supply in your opinion? What do we do?
Yeah, so certainly there are the specific instances that are always, you know, different one-offs that could potentially help in those in this broader problem. But then, you know, there are, I would say, sort of the more general issues, which is this is something across the province. London's not, you know, alone in this, but certainly as far as time for approvals go, you know, the city has, I would say, over the pandemic, really tried to do a good job in continuing on and making sure that permits get approved and approvals come through. But I think one thing that we're seeing is that if things were done in a bit more of an expedited fashion, I know it's a bit cliche, but certainly red tape is certainly a delay here. And if we can help expedite things in a more expeditious manner at City Hall, you know, we would be seeing more supply come online. And that's certainly a big piece. The other one, too, which is a really challenging piece for our industry specifically, but certainly anyone that's employing anyone right now is lack of skilled labor. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a huge challenge and something that we're certainly working on and trying to find ways that we can bring more people to London. And this is, you know, sort of to Mike Moffitt's piece, the sort of drive until you qualify, right? And one of the things that, you know, we certainly fear is we don't want families that are leaving the GTA driving past London because there's not enough opportunity here or there's not enough supply. And we want them to be able to be here and to be able to afford a home here. And those are going to be potentially people that are going to be helping build homes for the next number of years.
Well, I want to talk about the skilled labor point you just made for a second, because oftentimes if we look at, you know, a fast food chain or a retail type of environment, and they say, oh, there's a labor shortage. Oftentimes we can pretty quickly point to, well, you're offering minimum wage, so perhaps that's why there's a labor shortage. When we're talking about skilled labor to build homes, minimum wage is not what's on offer here. These are good paying jobs, and there's still a labor shortage.
Yes. So even from a general labor perspective, so if anyone that's building a home right now in London is a builder is looking for someone just to come on site, help clean a house, help assemble a few things, just sort of different tasks across the site that's not necessarily even skilled labor, mm-hmm. You know, looking at a minimum $20-$22 an hour. We've seen as much as $24, $25 an hour to be competitive in the market, even just for general labor. And, you know, one of the things that we are, you know, certainly trying to encourage with the association always, but specifically right now, is the importance of and the great benefits that you can have as a skilled trade. Skilled trades are, you know, if you're getting into the skilled trade now or you are currently doing it, this is probably one of the best times in the industry. You're probably working at breakneck pace. I mean, it's just that the demand is off the scale. So it's really just a matter of how much you want to be doing. But because of that and because the demand is so high, those jobs are in incredible demand and those jobs are paying very, very well. So for people that are looking for great, you know, ways of getting employed and being very productive, these are incredible jobs, whether it's a carpenter, electrician, plumber. They're all in demand. Everyone needs one right now as much as possible. And so the value that's put on them is very, very high.
Yeah, and I can understand why that would be the case. So there's a few different choke points here when it comes to the housing supply issue, but we have to talk about the planning aspect of this. And you get to come at this from, I would say, a very, very unique perspective, whereas here you are, you're the president of the Home Builders Association, but you've also been on council. So you've kind of been on both sides of the table here. When you look at where we're at as a city right now, how are you feeling about the way that we make some of our calls, the way we make some of our choices from a planning perspective?
For sure. And I just should correct quickly because we do have a president of our association.
Excuse me. Yes.
Sue Wastel, and then I'm the CEO.
Excuse me. Yes, I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Yep.
But certainly from the planning perspective, and I was on council when the London plan was coming together. And we certainly, I think when trying to plan for the future of a city, it's always really challenging because there are things that people want and what people want to see. And now we're getting to a point where, 5, 6, 7 years ago, trying to be able to predict what we're seeing right now was nearly impossible. No one saw this coming. And so one of the things that we have to be mindful of is being flexible on how we plan for our city. So we can put the best plans in place as possible, which is a helpful guide for how we're trying to plan for our city's future. At the same time, we're seeing where density is being looked for across the city and not necessarily just where the London plan has planned for it. And so these are some of the challenges we're certainly facing. And when there's such a pent-up demand for more housing, I think we need to be a bit more nimble in the way that we're planning and trying to guide this, because we need to make sure that housing can get built and established in a timely fashion.
I couldn't agree more. And you use the word nimble. I'll use the word NIMBY, because that's part of it, right? That's part of the equation is, hey, I don't want this number of people moving in next to me. We saw it with the proposed apartment building that was being built over on Southdale there near the Hellenic Center basically anywhere in the city. Someone wants to build something that's a big, tall thing where a bunch of people are going to live there, there's going to be some complaints. So it's a matter of sort of sifting through those complaints and finding which ones have merit. My opinion would be the very, very small percentage of them, but still, we're going to have to sift through those complaints, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think we had newly minted councillor John Fife-Millar on your show, and I think he made a really good point where he said, I mean, I think he maybe said this at council talking about the Auburn development, but that infill is hard because of the impacts it has on neighbors. At the same time, I would say that the job of council and councillors is to look holistically across the city. What are the issues we're dealing with? Try and make for the best possible solution to a site-specific application. But need to have the foresight and say, these are going to be really important buildings to be built because we need these densities. I mean, one of the things that I know council is really focused on right now is climate change, right? Mm-hmm. And so the ability to build more density in our city is certainly one of the biggest ways that we can try and combat that, rather than, if we're not building in London, what we're seeing is people moving out to St. Thomas, to Lucan, to Strathroy, and, places across the region, because sometimes it's a little bit easier to build out there. But at the same time, that means there's less density in the city. It also means that people are accessing and utilizing our services here in London, not necessarily paying for them, and then also driving into the city every day.
Yeah. To me, what I think we should be trying to go for, and I know that the model of, I go to my office from 9 to 5 every Monday to Friday, that is something that perhaps might be left behind a little bit by this pandemic. But I do like the idea of, I live close to where I work. I can bike or walk or take an easy bus from where I live to where I work. That to me is what one of the more important things we should be focusing on as a city right now.
Certainly. And I mean, I think the most recent example of Auburn, downtown, right near City Hall, that is a very, very walkable area and neighborhood. And so that's a great example of, if we want people to kind of get out of their cars and start walking around downtown or to their place of work or work at home, that's a fantastic example of that.
Here's the example that I've used when talking about that particular project. Is some people, is this downtown? Is this not downtown? Depending on which version of the plan you look at, blah, 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 blah. I'm not that good at golf. I can hit a golf ball from City Hall to that the site of that development. It's downtown. I know that's not the official way we can do things, but again, I'm not that good at golf.
Well, and certainly it is very, precise and specific in framing the way that downtown officially sort of is shaped. But I would say if you talk to, 9 out of 10 people in London, I doubt most of them, including myself, would necessarily say, I know exactly where the boundaries of downtown are.
If you say to someone standing directly in front of Centennial Hall, are you downtown right now? 90% of people are going to say, yes, I am.
That would be my bet, for sure.
It might be higher than that.
I think it could be, for sure.
Yeah. So, again, that's not the way that it's written in on the tablets of London City Hall. But from a practicality perspective, that's downtown.
Yes.
Yeah. So in that case, and we look at, I mentioned Centennial Hall, but there's the parking lot next door. So there's a bunch of different projects that we're looking at as far as getting done in the core, which of course means building homes, which of course means more places for people to live. Is that something that we perhaps, and again, council did approve these projects, but do we have to get a little bit more aggressive with these things and perhaps be a little bit more willing to fight from a red tape perspective on making sure they happen?
I think so. And I mean, I would say, you know, kudos to council for, I think, having the wisdom to approve that project and certainly approving more projects is what we need to be seeing. But I would say, you know, one of the things that we see happen often, and I know I've seen it from a perspective of being on council where, hey, you know what, there's maybe an issue with this site. We need to make sure that X, X, and X are appropriate mm-hmm. and confirmed. But, you know, if there's a possibility of instead of, you know, deferrals or making something take a longer time, that we can expedite that process and be a bit more proactive in trying to find those solutions.
What kind of solutions can we look for here? Because, look, there's situations where, well, I don't want this or I don't want that. And you can meet in the middle on some of these things or, hey, if I do this, will you do that? And we can talk about, you know, affordable housing and things along those lines in a second. But what are some of these solutions as far as making these things more palatable, not just for politicians and counselors, but for people in the neighborhood and people in the city?
I think that's a great question. And it's a tough one because I think especially as there are infill projects, you know, dealing with neighbors and making sure that trying to get people on board is an important one. But I would say another piece too is certainly, you know, having plans and policies in place, but being flexible and open to those as guiding documents. And, you know, we also have what I would say are sort of helpful projections and guidance from the provincial level where it's, you know, we're looking for density, we're looking to increase density, we're looking for additional growth. And so maybe looking at some of those higher level policies than sometimes being too restrictive and, you know, we do tend to have a lot of secondary plans and policies that are very, you know, they're, I think, best intentions and good plans for areas and we try and follow them. But I think being open-minded and understanding that there is some flexibility, that those are guiding documents and not mm-hmm. necessarily, you know, the be-all, end-all, and that we have to be understanding of the circumstances and situations that we're in and being a bit more flexible to that as far as approvals go.
Let's talk about affordable housing. And we looked at the Auburn deal and there were 12 affordable housing units that came from that. Is that something that a lot of home builders, all home builders are open to when it comes to these types of negotiations with council as far as, hey, yeah, we'll put this number of affordable units at 70% market rate?
I would say it's something that the industry is becoming more and more open to and understanding that there's a huge need in our community. And, right. and certainly, you know, between ourselves and the London Development Institute, you know, the idea that and recognizing that affordable housing and the roadmap to 3,000 affordable housing units, which the mayor and council have recently were looking to adopt. And there's a huge aspect of that where private industry is looking to be involved. And we know that's coming. And we certainly know that's an area that we need to be looking at supporting. And I think it's being, you know, if we can have the conversations with council about how to do that in the most proactive and in a partnership way. Because, you know, I would say that most developers or builders would say, hey, we're not the experts on affordable housing. We're not the experts on affordable housing programming, right? So even as of yesterday, you know, we had a great opportunity to tour a number of builders and developers through Indwell's new project at 7044 Dundas Street, and they're building some units hopefully in Soho. Mm-hmm. So they've been a great partner there. And, you know, I think there's an opportunity for us to work with them as well as a number of the other affordable housing builders and providers in our city to try and find some partnerships where we can really make that work because we all recognize it's a problem and it's only getting more and more challenging and more the numbers are growing. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to be able to provide more affordable housing is something we know we're going to be having to do and step up to the plate to be able to do. So it's just really a question of how can we, working with the city, collaborate and do that to the best of our ability.
Yeah, and I know that some people listen to this right now and say, hey, you know, the provincial or municipal or even in some cases people have this opinion, federal government should be building, you know, affordable housing, you know, big buildings where people can pay, you know, this much less than market rate. To me, this is a problem that is just unsolvable without the private sector being on board and having some sort of say in it, right? Like it's going to have to be a team effort, a team approach.
Team effort for sure. And I would say that, you know, the one thing is that builders and developers aren't going to be able to solve this on their own.
Nope.
But, you know, again, working collaboratively with municipal government, provincial government, federal government, I think that's really the only way that we're going to be able to help solve this problem. Certainly, you know, builders being the ones that will help actually provide those homes. But finding the right partnership and way to do that, I mean, you know, I'll just give an example. So in the roadmap to 3000, there's two sort of particular items that, you know, I would say is where there's potential partnership even from a municipal level. So one is looking at DC updates in 2025 and seeing if there might be a component of that that might start to be contributed to affordable housing. And then there's something new which has come in into the province, and Toronto is the first municipality to do this, called inclusionary zoning. And so that in part has kind of replaced what we used to have as bonusing in Ontario. So now if a builder developer looking to build a high rise is saying, you know, if we were to put in 20 units of affordable housing, the city would say, okay, you know what, you can build three or four more stories and go up a little higher, and then we can make that partnership work. Now this is going to be done through inclusionary zoning, which specifies, I can't remember the exact phrase, but essentially on the major transit corridor routes, or what were the BRT corridor routes, where this could come into place, and essentially something similar where maybe there's an opportunity for, if a builder wants to build higher densities, a more significant number of the units could be put towards affordable housing. Now in Toronto, though, there really wasn't much of a partnership built in, where it's really, to your point before, it's all put on the developer or the builder. So it's made it really difficult and cumbersome on developers and builders to even want to come to the table on those fronts, because it's not that builders and developers have an unending pot of money that they can just take from, and these projects are just going to miraculously work. So, you know, either those homes overall become more expensive, or there needs to be something where the government comes in and helps subsidize that to some extent, however that might be.
Now, a question that's kind of unrelated, but as you took this new job after you'd spent 4 years on council and you saw the term bus rapid transit corridor in your professional life, did you kind of like want to throw your computer out the window, or like how did you feel in that particular moment? I thought I was done with this.
No, you know what? That was a long haul battle.
It was a battle. I think battle's a good word.
For sure. And it was tough. And I would say it's, you know, it was one of those items that I think I was certainly supportive of. And certainly a lot of people in my ward, I don't think were in support of it, and in large part, you know, led to my loss.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was also a really great opportunity for myself after the election just to kind of reflect, because I think when you're on city council, I mean, you know, you get very focused on the ideas and the work that you're doing. And I think sometimes there's that lost perspective of, well, what is the business community doing? What is the broader community doing on these items? What are they thinking about it? And I think certainly since then, having a bit of a wider perspective on that has been helpful, and I've certainly appreciated some of the insights that have been shared with me since then.
Yeah, certainly. I've just felt I needed to segue into that very briefly. I do want to talk, though. You mentioned the way that, you know, we're doing zoning and things along those lines. Let's talk about this project over at Fanshawe. That was a big one, and planning committee said no thanks to that one. We need more housing out there, though. I think that is just an unassailable truth. And I know there's concerns about sewer system, and we can talk about that, but there needs to be more places for people to live at Fanshawe. Otherwise, we're going to get in more and more and more into single family homes being turned into multi-student dwellings. And we get into, and I know that people don't like to use the term, but we get into student ghetto type conversations when you look at Fleming Drive, Thurman Circle, and places like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the proposal there around Fanshawe College, I mean, you know, again, is an example of, and I know Councillor Lewis, you know, and then certainly his area trying to make that work, you know, if possible. Unfortunately, I think it died on a referral, but certainly, you know, that going back to staff for some different options on how that could work, I think would be really useful, because as you say, you know, if we're looking at even more and more students coming to Fanshawe, which I think we're certainly looking for.
That's what the college wants.
It's what the college wants. Yeah. It's what the province wants. I think it's what our city wants. And certainly, you know, that's going to be future employees in our city, future families in our city. And so if there's not, you know, an appropriate place for them to live, they're going to find other places to live wherever that might be. And so if there's purpose-built housing that can really situate for students, I mean, that would be fantastic. And so, again, I think that is a potential solution, or at least one example of it. And if there's a way to make that work in a bit more of a creative fashion, then that's something we need to look at, because, again, otherwise, if we say no to something, we know that those problems are going to be elsewhere in our community.
Yeah, and I'm not saying we're going to have another Fleming Drive St. Patrick's Day riot, because that's the odds of that happening are infinitesimally low. However, I think that single-family homes are something that we should be trying to sort of protect in that area, and the way to do that is have other residential options.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's you need, you know, there's what we would, I think I would say, and the industry would say, is we need housing across the spectrum of housing, right? So it's not, you know, we don't need strictly just high density. High density is great. We need multi-unit residential, whether it's towns or stacked towns, walk-ups, and single detached, because I mean, there's a broad spectrum of people that are looking for different types of housing, and we really need to be able to meet the housing across that spectrum.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Let's talk about the province before we get out of here. There's a lot of talk from a provincial government perspective as far as what they can do when it comes to development, and I think that we're going to see a lot of Doug Ford, the developer's buddy, attack ads once we get back into the campaign, because we sort of kind of a preview of that going into December. What do you think are going to be some of the key issues when it comes to housing and creating more housing when it comes to the provincial election in June?
I think that's, the billion-dollar question.
And,
and certainly something
it's a several billion-dollar question.
And something the industry is certainly, I think, waiting to see what the province is going to be sharing, the current government, as well as what the other parties are going to be suggesting as far as policies to make that work. You know, we've heard different things, and whether that's, you know, certainly the Ford government has been a bit more top-down, and so if there may be an approach that comes from that direction, if it's more top-down policy making for municipalities. You know, one of the other pieces right now, which we're certainly in early discussions on at the provincial level, is growth projections for municipalities outside of the Greater Golden Horseshoe. So we're expecting that those projections are hopefully going to come in sometime early next year. But one of the things right now is that those projections don't necessarily have teeth to them. So if London, as an example, as a municipality, doesn't hit those growth targets, which might really be needed based off the demand that we're seeing right now and what the projections are for demand for housing and population growth over the next 10 years, you know, there's not really much of a tool in place to say, hey, we need to get our act together and make this happen. So if there's a, if that, you know, that an option comes down that way, you know, that'll be an interesting one. But it's going to be, I think, a bit of a battle to some extent between the provincial and municipal levels, because, you know, we know across the board that there are these issues and every municipality is dealing with them. At the same time, every municipality is slightly different, or there's differences in each municipality. So it's not something that's easy just to lay a rule across the board. But I think we're certainly keeping our eye to see if it goes in that direction.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to sort of see what plays into the election from a housing affordability perspective. Because like that, we talk all the time, like, you know, what matters in elections is pocketbook issues. What is more of a pocketbook issue than can you afford a place to live?
And I would say that, you know, in most discussions I've had around this, you know, housing affordability, I think, is going to be, and affordability in general is probably going to be the number one issue as we get into the elections next year. And because it's on the minds of everyone. I mean, I can't, you know, go somewhere without talking to someone about, hey, how crazy is it how the, you know, prices in London have gone up? And, you know, I would just say it's this housing supply crisis issue. And if we had more supply, you know, certainly that ability to meet that demand and have those prices level off is going to be one of the biggest things for our community.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens there. It's going to be an interesting 6 months that we have got coming up ahead of us for sure. Jared, thank you so much for doing this. I wish you and the family a happy Hanukkah season. You're wearing your Hanukkah sweater, which is fantastic.
I mean, the festive spirit. Thanks,
yeah, you're
Greg.
In the festive spirit. But really, thank you and appreciate you coming in and doing this and talking with us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Greg.
That's Jared Zafman, who's the CEO of the London Home Builders Association. We will wrap up the podcast there. Thank you very much for listening this week. A couple more episodes coming next week. We're going to talk about the walkability of London next week, which is a topic that I've got some personal experience with as someone who uses my feet as the way that I get to and from work. So we're going to talk about that on Tuesday's edition of the Craig Needles Podcast. Cheryl Ruth is going to join me, so hopefully you can tune in for that episode. We can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and of course you can find us on londonnewstoday.ca as well. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Craig Needles Podcast. We'll talk to you next week.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of Blackburn Media.